This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Welcome. And look, a big thanks for all those incredible stories of adoption you're sharing on the All in the Mind blog after last week's show. They're incredibly moving, I have to say. But now today, imagine if I gave you a glass of milk and it tasted blue to you. Or if your partner's voice just felt like a wonderful golden brown, the colour of buttery toast. What if the number 2 and letter J conjured up the shade of letterbox red, or the name Derek tasted like earwax? Or whenever you heard music, a kaleidoscope of colours exploded inside your head, different tones and textures for different notes. Vladimir Nabokov was one, so is artist David Hockney. In fact, 1 in 100 of us could be a person with synesthesia, the surprising cross-wiring of the senses in the brain. My guest today heads up one of the top centres in synesthesia research, based at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. This cold, this water, this sun. By day, he's a leading neuroscientist, but by night, he writes novels. And he's just been in Australia to perform with Brian Eno at the Sydney Opera House, a piece based on his totally intriguing new novel called Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives. So meet the energetic David Eagleman.
In the moment of transition between life and death, only one thing changes. You lose the momentum of the biochemical cycles that keep the machinery running. In the moment before death, you are still composed of the same 1,000 trillion trillion atoms as in the moment after death. As you degrade, your atoms become incorporated into new constellations, the leaf of a staghorn fern, a speckled snail shell, a kernel of maize, a beetle's mandible, a waxen bloodroot, a ptarmigan's tail feather. But it turns out, your 1,000 trillion trillion atoms were not an accidental collection. Each was labeled as composing you, and continues to be so wherever it goes. So you're not gone, you're simply taking on different forms. Instead of your gestures being the raising of an eyebrow or a blown kiss, now a gesture might consist of a rising gnat, a waving wheat stalk, and the inhaling lung of a breaching beluga whale. Your manner of expressing joy might become a seaweed sheet playing on a lapping wave, a pendulous funnel dancing from a cumulonimbus, a flapping grunion birthing, a glossy river pebble gliding around an eddy. From your present, clumped point of view, this afterlife may sound unnervingly distributed, but in fact it is wonderful. You can't imagine the pleasure of stretching your redefined body across vast territories, ruffling your grasses and bending your pine branch and flexing an egret's wing while pushing a crab toward the surface through coruscating shafts of light. Lovemaking reaches heights it could never dream of in the compactness of human corporality. Now you can communicate in many places along your bodies at once. You weave your versatile hands over your lover's multiflorous figure. Your rivers run together. You move in concert as interdigitating creatures of the meadow, entangled vegetation bursting from the fields, caressing weather fronts that climax into thunderstorms.
Well, welcome to Australia, David Eagleman.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What's a neuroscientist writing a fantastical novel about the afterlife? Do you believe in the afterlife?
I have no idea. In some sense, the reason a scientist is writing this is because what you really learn as science is the vastness of our ignorance. You learn all the stuff we don't know. And the afterlife just happens to be one thing that's a perfect example of that. Everyone seems to have a strong opinion about whether it does or doesn't exist and what it might or might not look like. But the fact is, all of us are completely shooting in the dark. And so the idea of this book was to write 40 mutually exclusive stories that, in some sense, celebrates our uncertainty.
And there are delicious uncertainties. I mean, in this collection of stories, the character you call God takes many forms. I mean, in one story, he's a bacterium. In another, she's frustrated at having to judge people's lives in a binary way, good and evil. In another vignette, he gets sacked and replaced by a committee.
That's right. Essentially what I was doing is I looked at the sort of basic ideas. If you stopped someone on the street and said, hey, what do you think the afterlife is about? Of course, everybody just has in their mind whatever their parents or their community has told them. And when you really start putting those ideas under the spotlight, what you discover is they're ridiculous. So, for example, the one where God is getting frustrated at having to do this binary categorization into good and evil, it's just a perfect example of how goofy the story is because people are much more multidimensional than that. They're much more complex than that. And so in that story, God decides to sort of revolt against that structure that she had set up, and she instead invites everybody to come into heaven and to be a part of heaven. And what ends up happening, actually, if I can just read the last line here. So she brings everyone to heaven and everyone's achieved true equality. And the communists are baffled and irritated because they have finally achieved their perfect society, but only with the help of a God in whom they didn't want to believe. The meritocrats are abashed that they're stuck for eternity in an incentiveless system with a bunch of pinkos. The conservatives have no penniless to disparage. The liberals have no downtrodden to promote. So God sits on the edge of her bed and weeps at night because the only thing everyone can agree upon is that they're all in hell.
One of my favourite scenarios is God as a single lonely quark particle dashing across the space-time continuum, drawing the world into being with energetic pencil strokes. It's a classic scene.
Yeah, in that story, God is just a quark as he races back and forth through time. He's essentially leaving little pencil strokes, and he discovers that he can draw the whole universe that way, and we are his drawing, essentially. And he's a great storyteller and loves to tell these stories.
But, yeah. I mean, playfully, this is about, you know, us not coming into the world through an entity bigger than us, say the Big Bang, but in fact by something infinitesimally smaller than us.
That's right. A lot of what I'm doing in this book is really trying to play with ideas and provide a mental stretching. So when I sit next to people on airplanes and I ask them what their opinion is on whether there's a God and what that would look like and what an afterlife would look like, it turns out that there's such a lack of creativity. Everybody just says whatever their parents have told them. So this book is all about really mentally stretching on spatial scales and ideas of gender and number and all sorts of things.
It's a great little novel, and look, you're playing with the metaphysical here, and I wonder to what extent there is room for what has become a very material enterprise, neuroscience, your enterprise, for the metaphysical and the philosophical, even the theological. Is there room for any of this in the neuroscientific effort?
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful question. Yeah, I think in any scientific effort, all of the big pieces of progress always come about from wacky leaps of faith in some way. The science textbooks always paint the picture as though it's a linear process where someone discovers something and then the next step happens, and the next step happens, and it turns out that's complete BS. Science never works that way. It's always people leaping onto some island where they have no right to be there, and then they look back and figure out if they can build a bridge to what we know. And when they can, then that's science, that's progress. And so I think that with neuroscience, there's so much media attention where we sort of act like we know everything. And the fact is, we are absolutely at the foot of the mountain with the brain. I'm saying this as someone who's devoted my life to it. You know, I've written books on the brain, and we have massive textbooks in the field. But in fact, there's so little that we understand.
And yet we're seduced by the bright lights of the brain scan, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, which is funny because it is just a false seduction in some ways. I mean, I don't mean to imply that we haven't learned a ton with this whole armamentarium of technology that we have. We are making progress, but it really is baby steps. And the biggest questions, the 800-pound gorillas in the room, we haven't even touched those. Questions like how consciousness comes about, how you ever string together tens of billions of pieces and parts and get something out of it that has private subjective experience. So if I were to hand you billions of Tinker Toys, you know, these little toys that you put together, and you start hooking them up so that when you touch this, that happens and so on, At what point would you add one more Tinker toy and say, ah, now this is having conscious experience? We don't even know what the theory would look like on that. I mean, here's another way of looking at it. When I was a child, I absolutely expected that by the time I was this age, we would have robots, that we would have C-3PO serving our dinner and cleaning my room and so on. The best we have is the Roomba vacuum cleaner. And it turns out that things like intelligence is really, really hard to figure out. And even things like computer vision is very, very difficult.
Before we come to your own research, which is extraordinary too, in another scenario in your new novel, Some, we're really reminded of what a unique experience it is to occupy the brains and bodies that we do. You have your character in the book, us, choose to come back as anything we want to in the afterlife, and we choose to come back as a horse. And it all goes sort of potentially horribly wrong, doesn't it?
Right. So in this story, you get treated to this generous opportunity where you can choose to come back as whatever you want. So you decide you want to come back as a horse because you want simplicity, and the idea of being a horse seems so lovely to you. So a magic wand is waved, you start to metamorphose into a horse. And
I mean, you can feel your fingers blending hoofward, as you put it. Synapses,
yes,
unplugging and replugging on their way to equestrian patterns. I love it.
Yes, and this mat of strong hair erupts to cover you, and your musculature and your skeleton starts changing. You start becoming a horse, and it's really lovely for a moment. And then you become aware of the problem you overlooked, which is that the more you become a horse, the more you forget the original wish. You forget what it was like to be a human, wondering what it was like to be a horse. And so this is this moment of revelation that serves as the punishment for your sins, because you realize that you won't be able to ever return here, and that your slide down the intelligence ladder is irreversible. And then the last line of the story is, just before you lose your final human faculties, you painfully ponder, what magnificent extraterrestrial creature, enthralled with the idea of finding a simpler life, chose in the last round to become a human.
And that's it. You will never understand what it was to be a human. You will never be able to wish to be anything but a horse.
That's right.
Professor David Eagleman is my guest on All in the Mind this week. I'm Natasha Mitchell, coming to you on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, and globally on Radio Australia and as podcast. And David's new novel is called Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives, published by Pantheon Books, which he's performed this month on stage at the Sydney Opera House in a collaboration with Brian Eno, whose strains you can hear under us. But David Eagleman is one prolific neuroscientist. There's more. The fact that you're a neuroscientist by day but writes fiction by night is perhaps not a surprise, because you head up a centre for synesthesia research at the Baylor College of Medicine. And in many ways, you know, the experience of synesthesia is wrapped up in the way we use metaphors, just like novel writing is, how we use metaphors to describe the world.
Yeah, synesthesia is a condition that about 1% of the population has, and some researchers have estimated that there are maybe 152 reported forms of synesthesia. They have a mixture of the senses. So, for example, if you have synesthesia, you might hear music and it causes you to physically see colors. Or more common versions are things like the numbers and the letters of the alphabet having colors, or textures or shapes or genders or personalities. You might taste something and it makes you feel like you're feeling something on your fingertips, or you might hear something and that puts a taste in your mouth. For one synesthete, for example, whenever he hears the name Derek, it tastes like earwax to him. It puts the taste of that in his mouth. And for other people, you know, for different words, it puts the taste of cinnamon in their mouth, or some metallic taste in their mouth, and so on. It's not just that they're being silly or metaphorical or artistic. It's actually that there's cross-wiring in their brain, so that from the parts of their brain that care about hearing and the parts of their brain that care about taste, there's a little bit of crosstalk going on. So particular auditory experiences will trigger gustatory experiences. There are many different forms of synesthesia, but what they all have in common is that they represent a blending of the senses. And it used to be thought this was very rare, but we now know that it's really quite common. It's at least 1% of the population. And so to come back around to your question, because of this increased crosstalk in the brain, it has been suggested that maybe synesthesia is related to creativity and metaphor, because essentially that's what it is for somebody to be very creative or to speak in metaphor, is to find parallels across different domains in the brain. So as an example, there are many phrases in the English language that were probably introduced by synesthetes, and they sort of stuck around in the language. So when we talk about cool jazz, or sharp cheese, or a loud tie, or even a sweet personality, things like that, these are all phrases that represent a connection across different domains that sort of normally shouldn't happen, and they were probably introduced by synesthetes.
I mean, in fact, you've just written another new book, Wednesday is Indigo Blue, with another trailblazer in synesthesia research, Richard Siderwick. 40% of synesthetes see with their ears. What's coloured hearing?
Coloured hearing is where there's a sound and that triggers a visual experience for you. So one of the pictures we have in the book is a very beautiful painting of a woman who, whenever the furnace kicks on and goes whoosh, she has a very rich visual experience associated with them. And many painters, like let's say Kandinsky, had colored hearing. And so what he would do is turn on the music and have the music blaring, and he would stand in front of his canvas and paint the colors and the textures and the shapes that were triggered.
I mean, you've worked with many people who have synesthetic experiences. And I mean, give people a sense of what it's like to live with this experience. Is there a form or an incarnation of synesthesia that surprised even you?
Some of the synesthetes I work with have very rich synesthesia. So one woman is a musician, and her synesthesia is so rich that different notes have personality and gender and color and form to them. Different instrument timbres have this sort of thing, different chords or intervals. And not only that, but different sorts of runs of notes will make her feel things physically, that she's in different body positions, kinesthetically, about to leap or tripping over a stair or things like that. And it's not that she's just being poetic about it. It's that it's actually the parts of her brain that care about music are tied into parts of her brain that care about color and form and texture and shape and movement. And this is one of the great lessons of synesthesia, is that people's realities can be quite different on the inside. For a synesthete, they accept that as their reality. So if a colorblind person asked you, what is it like to see colors? Is that distracting? Does it drive you crazy? It wouldn't have even struck you that reality could be different. There's no sense in which it's distracting or strange for them.
A sort of sensory clutter.
Yeah, it's not sensory clutter. In fact, most synesthetes will go through their entire life not ever suspecting that other people don't see the world they do.
And it's quite shocking to them when they realize, sometimes well late into life, that their world is quite different to the rest of us and how we experience our sensory world.
Quite right.
I mean, some people also see forms. So they might think of a series of numbers or days of the week, and they'll see them in form suspended in space in front of them. I mean, that sounds rather like an hallucination, doesn't it?
Yes, except that they're not actually seeing it there. So what you're describing is what we call spatial sequence synesthesia. And that's where people have, let's say, take the months of the year, January, February, March. They'll feel that each one of those has a specific location. So maybe January is off my left shoulder at about arm's length, and February is to the right of that, and March is to the right of that, but a little bit lower, and so on. Whenever they think about one of these elements of the sequence, it just seems self-evidently true to them that there's a spatial location that should go along with that. But here's the funny part. It's not that they're seeing it in space. Mm. It's just that they know it should be there. So as an example, imagine that there were a big orange pumpkin on the chair to the right of you. It's very easy for you to picture it there and even think about its color and its location and so on. But it's not a hallucination. You don't actually believe it's there. It's just that if I were to ask you later, hey, where's the pumpkin? You'd say, oh, it's over here to the right. That's its spatial location.
The key is that the experiences are actually quite specific. Those associations are quite specific. So someone might consistently, when they taste milk, they will visualize blue. And that will be the case over many, many years. In fact, there have been some hard-nosed skeptics about the very existence of synesthesia, arguing that it's, you know, it's people attention-seeking or just simply the metaphorical connections that we've made between the senses as we were learning as kids.
Yeah, there actually are no more skeptics now. Here's why. For about 100 years, synesthesia fell out of the scientific spotlight. mostly because of the behaviorist school of thought, which said, you know, we're essentially reflex machines, input, output, and you weren't even really allowed to talk about private subjective experience. But what's become more interesting in neuroscience lately is to say, well, you know, it actually feels like something to experience reality and have consciousness. And so that's now a real area of study. And so what happened is my co-author, Richard Cytoic, essentially reintroduced synesthesia in the late 80s. He wrote a book called The Man Who Tasted Shapes and really put synesthesia back on the map. And then that induced younger scientists like me to start really studying this in earnest. And what my lab and other labs have done now is develop rigorous methods of testing for synesthesia. And essentially the way this works is by testing their consistency. So just as a quick example, let's say you have colored letters. So I present you with the letter J, and you pick from a color palette of 16 million different possible colors, you pick exactly the color that best matches your letter J. And to you, J is green. Those are equivalent concepts. And you experience greenness in your head. And so I end up showing you all the letters and numbers in random order, three times each. And then you see the letter J 57 trials later. If you're a real synesthete, you'll pick out exactly the same shade of green. If you're faking it, there's no way you're going to get it. And so what we're able to do in this way, by testing the internal consistency of your answers, is very sensitively discriminate who's synesthetic and who's not.
There have been some quite compelling brain scan work revealing that this is in fact an experience that is in the visual part of the brain where colors are registered.
Yes, that's right. So the neuroimaging in some sense has verified what we already knew, and it's nice to have the confirmation. So what it shows is that, for example, the parts of the brains that care about numbers and letters and the parts of the brain that care about colors, they're right next to each other, and in synesthetes there's an increased amount of crosstalk there. When the synesthete sees a letter, it actually tickles into activity the part of their brain that cares about color.
I mean, you even go as far as to argue that synesthesia is really forcing a paradigm shift in the orthodox view of the brain and how it's organized. That's quite a claim. How is it?
It turns out that when we think about how the brain constructs reality, it's a very challenging question, and always has been, because we're essentially like fish trying to describe water. We've never experienced anything other than it, and so it's very difficult to wrap our heads around. But synesthesia is a really good inroad into discovering the ways in which reality is a construction of the brain, and that different brains can do it differently. And depending on your genes and a, you know, single nucleotide change in one gene somewhere on one chromosome, you can actually experience reality very differently. And so somebody's water is very different from someone else's.
I mean, it's challenging at its core what has traditionally been a very modular view of the brain, that senses and actions happen in very distinct parts of the brain and never the twain shall meet.
That's right. And we know that it's much more fluid than that now. And depending on which parts are talking with which parts, that changes how you perceive reality.
One interesting suggestion is that, in fact, we're all latently synesthetic. It's just that the connections between the senses are something that we're not all consciously aware of. Synesthetes are, that in a sense there's a lack of inhibition between different parts of the sensory brain.
That's exactly right. When you look at the anatomy of the brain, there's something very surprising, which is you have fibers carrying visual information that are plugging into the auditory part of the brain, and you have auditory fibers plugging into visual. And when you look carefully at the microanatomy, you find that everything is completely cross-wired. This is in all brains. Now, the strange part is, under normal circumstances, you don't experience visual things in an auditory manner or vice versa. But it turns out, so we know now, about 1% of the population does. Yet these connections exist in everybody. And so when people take drugs, when non-synesthetes take drugs like LSD or DMT, they can experience synesthesia. It's also the case that sometimes if you get very fatigued, you can experience synesthesia. So if you're just falling asleep and somebody slams the door, you might see colors or shapes. And these things are essentially unmasking these connections that already exist in everybody. And so it turns out that what synesthetes appear to be are those that actually have conscious access. Nonetheless, there are ways in which we can tease this out in everybody. So for example, if I were to take a piano and I were to hit the high note, ding, 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 and then I were to hit the low note, dong, 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 and I were to ask you, which one is brighter? What would you say?
Well, I'd say the high note.
Right. And if I asked you which one is bigger, what would you say?
Well, the low note, weirdly enough.
Yeah, right. Well, it turns out everybody does that. It turns out everybody gives the same answer to that, which is really hilarious because there's no reason why an auditory sound should map on to brightness or size, but it does in all brains. And so this is the sense in which we all have this crosstalk going on in our brains that links different parts.
So synesthesia may sort of lie on a continuum with ordinary perception, basically.
Yeah, you know, here's the weird part, though. We think that you're either synesthetic or you're not, and we don't exactly understand why that is, but essentially some people really have access to it and other people don't have access to it in terms of, let's say, colored letters or heard, you know, seeing music, things like that.
Well, David Eagleman, one other suggestion is that, in fact, we're all born totally, absolutely synesthetic, the blooming, buzzing confusion and profusion of neurons that, you know, is what occupies babies' brains, is sort of synesthetic by default. And then as those connections are pruned away, as our brain develops into adolescence, we lose our synesthetic ability. What do you make of that theory?
Well, it is the case that when you're born, your brain does a lot of refinement over the first few years. So it is true that you have a lot more cross-modal connections when you're first born. Whether that is exactly like the experience of synesthesia, we actually have no way of knowing, because most synesthesias, for example, are triggered by things like letters and numbers and weekdays and months. These are all overlearned sequences that you learn when you're, let's say, 4 or 5 years old. And so you can't ask a baby what color is Wednesday because they haven't learned that yet. So synesthesia is something that expresses itself later. So we don't actually have any good idea about what experience is like for a baby. Even though we were all there, we all forgot to write down the memories of it.
In a sense, you need language to be able to articulate your synesthetic experience.
Yeah.
Do you think you're any closer to understanding why some people are so especially synesthetic and the rest of us aren't?
Yeah, so what I'm doing is working on pulling the gene for that, and I think this is going to be the first hit in something that I'm calling perceptual genomics. So the idea is there are great genetics labs all over the planet now who are busy pulling the genes for eye color, height, weight, aortic stenosis, diabetes, all kinds of things like this. But what hasn't happened yet is seeing how single changes in genes map onto how you perceive reality. There are various competing theories about what exactly is causing synesthesia, and once we've pulled the gene for it, or a gene for
one gene, many genes, a whole network of genes, I would
precisely
imagine.
It's almost certain to be multiple genes involved in it. But once we've pulled those, then we'll know mechanistically, we'll actually know how you can change a little thing here, let's say with a, you know, changing one little bit of an inhibitory receptor in the brain, and that changes the way you perceive the world. That's going to be a very different kind of science than what we've had before.
So it might actually drive the sort of hyperconnectivity between different sensory parts of the brain.
That's right. And the debate has been whether it's actually physical wiring that's connecting, where you have more physical wiring in a synesthete, or the hypothesis that I favor is that there's the same amount of wiring in everybody's brain, but it has to do with the balance of inhibition and excitation.
Does working with synesthetics actually change your perception of the world, especially given that you're a novelist by night?
It causes me to pay a lot more attention to how I perceive reality and just be a lot looser about the knowledge that it's not one size fits all, and that being inside different people's heads yields very different things.
Nothing's normal.
That's right. I mean, we can talk about normality in a statistical sense. Most people are not synesthetic, and so they perceive colors and music and letters in a particular way, but it's up for grabs. There's no sort of right way to see the world.
Well, the other realm that you also research is time perception. Love to talk about that another time. We're right out of that, though. And look, thanks for joining us on the program this week, and good luck with the productions with Brian Eno, David Eagleman.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to hear Brian Eno speaking with David Eagleman, I've linked to the discussion they shared on Late Night Live with Philip Adams. David's other new book, this one written with Richard Cytoic, is called Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia, just published by MIT Press. And David heads up the Centre for Synesthesia Research at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. References, links, the audio transcript, and our email at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, and pop into the All in the Mind blog for a read and your say too. My thanks to Anita Barrow. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and next week, love is a battlefield. Ciao for now.
The internet, in many respects, is the greatest projection of Western power in terms of choice, in terms of empowerment, in terms of markets, in terms of giving the role to the individual, empowerment to the individual. ICANN, in many respects, is a reflection of the sort of bottom-up participatory models that we in the West tend to like.
That's the head of ICANN, the international body that helps coordinate how we find things online. It's changing, so what does that mean for the web? That's Future Tense. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.